Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
Part 5 of the General Catechetical Directory treats of catechesis according to age levels. It points up, first of all, the various methods and plans by which the Christian message is made to meet the various needs of men. Secondly, it makes a careful distinction between catechesis proper, given to baptized believers, and evangelization, which is directed to those who have not yet been regenerated in baptism and have not yet received the good news of salvation. And thirdly, it particularly stresses not only the need for carefully distinguishing among different age and maturity levels of the faithful being catechized, but emphasizes the necessity for religious instruction on every level, from preschool children to adults. All of these features of this section of the General Catechetical Directory I commend to your careful reading and reflection. And as parents and teachers, to your implementation. But since these lectures are intended to supplement the directory, or from another viewpoint, to go behind it, and supply such analysis as the directory makes no claim to making, my plan for the next two lectures is to presume what the directory says and concentrate on two subjects which I shall take in sequence. The first is the religious training of our supernature, and the second is the religious training of our superpersonality. The religious training of our supernature. As we enter this subject, I think there is some call for explaining why I chose to speak on the topic. It sounds a bit odd, the religious training of our supernature. If the title seems strange, and it does, the matter is not strange at all. What I wish to say now is that before we finish this series of lectures, we should make very plain to ourselves that the people who are to be catechized, since they are baptized believers, have not only a physical nature of body and spirit, and within the spirit a mind and will, but they have a physical supernature, which is the infused life of grace that elevates them to a sharing God's Trinitarian existence. In a word, they have, besides their natural life of body, emotions, and psychic powers, a supernatural life that we called deiform, because it makes the one who has it a participant in the very life which God has by divine right, and those possessed of grace have by divine favor as a sublime gift of His goodness. Why is it valuable, not to say imperative, that we reflect on the possession of this higher than natural life of the educand towards whom Catholic catechesis is, or at least should be, directed? The reason is that while an awareness of the different levels of people being catechized is important, and no sound Christian pedagogy should ignore these levels, the same people have a life of grace which transcends the stadia or strata of merely natural life and existence. Naturally speaking, there are the different levels of chronology depending on the age of a person. There are the different levels of psychology depending on the mental and emotional capacity and maturity of a person. There are the different levels of sociology depending on the society and environment from which a child or adolescent comes and in which he is being reared. These and similar levels of human nature cannot be ignored, and good religious education must take them seriously into account. But is that all? Emphatically not. The Christian educand has not only a natural life whose levels are to be recognized and respected, he also has a supernatural life, which, to coin three terms, is trans-chronological. He is trans-psychological and he is trans-sociological. While therefore paying attention to the child's or adolescent's age, mental and emotional status, and social background, the Catholic parent and teacher has a further, and if anything, equally grave responsibility to be aware of his supernatural life of grace. Which may indeed be affected by age, status, or environment, but strictly speaking is not dependent on these, either for its existence or its development in the life of God. Thus, an infant of 1 week or a mentally retarded child of 6 years, if baptized, both possess the supernatural life of grace and are ready heirs of heaven. On the other hand, an adult genius of 40 who refuses to believe and is living in grave sin does not possess the life of God in him, though naturally alive and perhaps a great leader among men, a Nobel Prize winner, yet supernaturally he is lifeless and estranged from his Creator. To make my point still more clear, let me recall that Christ gave us as the model for our imitation what? It was a little child. The Gospels are full of scandals. This is one for the natural man. Remember the warning? I tell you frankly, he said, if you do not change and become like little children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The strongest statement we can make is a universal negative. Unless we become like little children, we shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. What is Christ saying? That the chronological age of a man is irrelevant in God's sight, or a man's mental abilities, or his background, or stratum in society. All of these, from God's viewpoint, by comparison with the life of grace, are meaningless. What matters is the life of God in him, and at death is having or not having this life in his soul. All that I have said so far, as long as it was actually only introductory or propaedeutic to my principal focus, which may be expressed in one sentence. Since the supernatural life is eminently vital, in other words, it is a life, it requires, as all life does, proper nourishment, and the right atmosphere, even to remain alive, let alone to grow and develop. This sustenance and development is promised us on Christ's words, especially by two things: by the use of the sacraments, and by fidelity to prayer. Consequently, I return to the original title of the conference, but now paraphrase it by saying that essential to Catholic religious education is the proper training of our supernature through adequate instruction in the meaning and value of the sacraments and the meaning and value of prayer. And both so taught as to be directed to motivation, so that the person educated will not only know about the sacraments or about prayer, but will receive the sacraments and will pray. Any other estimate of Catholic pedagogy, in my estimate, would be a form of Gnosticism. It would lack the purpose or finality of Christian catechesis. What is the purpose of Christian catechesis? It is to have the Christian sustain and develop the supernatural life with which God had graced him at baptism. In other words, the goal of Christian education is praxis, not gnosis. It is action, not cerebration, or cerebration only insofar as it leads to action. In order to capsulize a comprehensive subject, let me say a word about each of the two principal means in which the catechist should train the young. As the divinely provided means of supernatural survival and development, I shall address myself to the Eucharist and to prayer. Among the sacraments, the Eucharist is par excellence the nourishment of the supernatural life. The two unity councils of Florence for the Greeks and of the Council of Trent for the Protestants dealt at length with the absolute need we have of the Blessed Sacrament to retain and grow in the life of grace. The immediate effect of the Eucharist, so the Council of Trent teaches, in the soul of a person who receives it worthily, is to unite him with Christ. Since it is by grace that a man is incorporated into Christ, and united to Christ's members, it follows, so Trent says, that those who receive this sacrament worthily receive an increase of grace. And all the effects which material food and drink have on the life of our body, maintaining and increasing life, restoring health, and bringing pleasure, all these effects this sacrament has on our supernatural life. Unquote, Trent. And I might just insert a brief comment on this bringing pleasure. One of the main functions of the Eucharist is to make us enjoy living the life of God. To meet the widespread neglect of the Eucharist in Reformation times and its denial by the Reformers, the Council of Trent further delineated the fruits of Holy Communion. Our Savior instituted this sacrament just before leaving the world to return to his Father. He poured out the riches of his love by its institution and ordered us to receive it for the preservation of his memory. Now I quote Trent again. It was his will that this sacrament be received as the soul's spiritual food to sustain and build up those who live with his life, as he said, "He who eats me, he also shall live because of me." This sacrament is also to be a remedy to free us from our daily defects and keep us from mortal sin. It was Christ's will, moreover, that this sacrament be a pledge of our future glory and our everlasting happiness, and finally, a symbol of that one body of which He is the head. So far, Trent. This unitive purpose of the sacrament is more than symbolic. Our physical lives, we know, are not only individual, but social. And we should expect Christ to provide for the corporate dimension of our life of grace by giving us the means to cultivate that God-like charity which joins the members of His mystical body. In other words, we have two lives to sustain and develop, both naturally and supernaturally, individual and social. On the supernatural level, the Eucharist sustains both our individual lives of grace, so that we as persons remain in God's friendship and grow in the same, and also sustains and develops our social life, especially through an increase of the infused virtue of charity. This is beautifully illustrated in the liturgical prayer that has come down to us from the first century. The text of this prayer has been incorporated into the Eucharistic liturgy since the Second Vatican Council. It says, "As this broken bread was scattered over the hills, and then, when gathered, became one mass, so may the church be gathered from the ends of the earth into thy kingdom, for thine is the glory and the power through Jesus Christ forevermore." Unquote. The unitive power of the Eucharist is contained in the person of the Savior, the author of grace, and the head of the mystical body, who is offered in the Mass and received in Holy Communion, so that through Him we may receive the spirit of charity, in which we are bidden to live no longer our own life, but the life of Christ, and to love the Redeemer Himself in all the members of His social body. So much for the Eucharist. Similar to the necessity of the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, to retain and grow in the supernatural life is the need of constant prayer. St. Robert Southwell, the Jesuit poet canonized by Pope Paul VI in 1970, wrote about this necessity. The passage I quote occurred in a short poem he published just before his martyrdom in 1595. Says Southwell, "Nothing more grateful in the highest eyes, nothing more firm in danger to protect us
nothing more forcible to pierce the skies, and not depart till mercy do respect us. And as the soul life to the body gives, so prayer revives the soul. By prayer it lives. Unquote. Robert Southall. Hidden in the mystery of prayer is a supernatural providence by which God predetermined from eternity to bestow the graces which He foresaw we would pray for. St. Robert Bellarmine, with apologies for quoting another Jesuit saint, show that here too the order of grace is fully consistent with the order of nature. In both cases, the ultimate effective agent is the almighty power of the first cause, namely God. And equally in both cases, secondary causes must be cooperative at the risk of not obtaining the effect desired. In the natural order, God has decreed to give us food and drink, and all that we need to sustain the life of the body. But He has also ordained to give us these necessities through human effort, by which the fields and vines are cultivated. Would anyone deny the need of plowing and sowing, of planting and digging, and other like labors, if we want to reap and gather in the harvest? You see what Bellarmine is saying? God, being God, could feed 1,000,000 worlds without anyone planting a seed or ever plowing a field. But He chose not to. We must plant and we must harvest. Otherwise, though God is God and Almighty, we would starve. The same is true in the realm of grace. Prayer corresponds to the secondary causes in nature, to the sowing and the plowing and the harvesting and the baking and the cooking. In the providence of God, it is the ordinary means of obtaining sustenance for the supernatural life. Unless we cooperate, especially through prayer, though we have that life of grace, we should die.
This conference is continued on Side B.